It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the woman behind a new plan to create a savings program for long-term care, similar to Wisconsin's EdVest College Savings Plan.
First, we're taking a look at a special series being published this summer in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The series is a collaboration between the Journal Sentinel, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and the O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University. It's called Poor Health, and it's about the link between poverty and health.
The reporter behind that series joins us now to discuss the connection and how it plays out in Milwaukee. Lillian Thomas is the assistant managing editor of special projects at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Lillian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Rob.
Well, part of the story you're telling is a story of the mission of hospitals and how that has changed. How did hospitals go from being something intended mainly to serve the poor, as you write, to a place that often avoids serving the poor whenever possible?
Well, we wrote about most hospitals were started as purely charitable groups, foundations, and were founded at a time when wealthier people had their own doctors, and hospitals were just for poor people and just for people who couldn't pay. Gradually, those hospitals, to meet expenses, began to charge patients. And then the next thing that really turned the corner was when private insurance and then government insurance became available. And suddenly, hospitals they weren't getting money from foundations or from wealthy donors or from patients. They were getting money from insurance. So that really flipped the whole way hospitals operated, beginning in the 30s and then really ramping up in the 60s with Medicare and Medicaid.
So they were competing for people with insurance, people they could make money from.
Correct. And also one of my hospital official sources said to me, once you began using other people's money, things changed because you no longer had an incentive to keep prices low, because you were being reimbursed by the procedure and you were being reimbursed for whatever you charged back in the day. So hospitals could make a lot of money and then insurers could make a lot of money. So there was just this incentive for a lot of people to jump into the market and start expanding.
And in the long term, you write that hospitals started closing in poor areas, poor urban areas in particular. When did that start happening?
Really began to see that in the 70s and ramping up a lot in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. The hospitals would have a poor reimbursement for Medicaid, and that changed because Medicaid originally reimbursed at about the same levels as Medicare and private insurance. But over the years, those reimbursements dropped, and so the hospital wasn't getting everything back for Medicaid patients. And in poor areas, most of your patients would either have no insurance, which meant you got no money from them, or that you would get a Medicaid-level reimbursement. And that made it harder and harder for hospitals to survive in poor neighborhoods.
Well, tell the story of how the hospital landscape, the healthcare landscape, has changed in Milwaukee.
What we really wanted to do was document with data what we felt in our guts we were seeing. I saw this in Pittsburgh and I saw it in Milwaukee. And we looked to map where hospitals were 10, 20, 30 years ago and where they started disappearing and where they started reappearing. And what we saw was what our research led us to expect, which was in poor neighborhoods, you lost hospitals like the public hospital in Milwaukee in the county, and St. Michael's and some of the other inner-city hospitals. We focused on one which had various names. It was called Milwaukee Hospital and Lutheran Hospital and then Sinai Samaritan. But that hospital was serving downtown patients and eventually affiliated with Sinai, but then was shut down because it was struggling and having lower and lower patient counts. And as we also wrote, at the same time, because hospitals began to follow the money, they began to follow the wealthier, insured, privately insured patients, they began opening facilities in the suburbs. And that's a pattern we saw throughout the United States as the 52 metropolitan maps that we have on the project demonstrate, that you just see that in almost every single metropolitan area in the United States.
We've heard talk about food deserts where people don't have access to affordable, healthy food. Are we seeing healthcare deserts?
We really are. It's it's a little difficult to talk about in cities, and a lot of people I would speak to, hospital officials, would say, how can you call it a desert when 5 miles away they have a perfectly good hospital? But what we found when we started talking to people is when you lose the hospital, you lose the doctors. The doctors go where they can be affiliated with a hospital. There's poor infrastructure. There's not labs. There's not other services they might want. And so if you live in a densely poor area, and particularly obviously out in the rural areas, you see real deserts where there's just no hospital at all. But in urban areas, what you see is people don't have the institution there. They don't have doctors. And if you're working a job and don't have daycare and have to take 2 buses and to get to a hospital, it becomes a bigger deal. Obviously, with this big emergency, you're going to go to an ER, but even there, the time it takes to get can mean that your service is slower and therefore your outcome might not be as good.
You paint a picture to kind of put a face on how this works of a Milwaukee resident named John Patton Jr. He has a lot of health needs. Can you just describe his life as it relates to health care?
Sure. Mr. Patton was a very engaging man. I met him at a free clinic where he goes, and he's very upbeat, really works hard at trying to find work, even though it's mostly been odd jobs. He had an injury more than 20 years ago at a foundry and has really not been able to find full-time work since. One of his regular gigs is as a Salvation Army bell ringer, and then he picks up little odd jobs. But for him, He lives on the north side, and he walks to clinics. He uses the emergency room as his regular service because he doesn't have a regular doctor, although now he is enrolled in Medicaid, and so he will now really have a home medical center where he can go. But up until very recently, his life was kind of cobbling things together. He would go to one place and get some information. He would go to a free clinic, but they wouldn't necessarily have his full records, so they might just treat something that was presented that day but not know about what else he had going on. So I think that what his story really showed was how complicated it can be when you're a low-income person and you don't have the means or the time or the sophistication. It was also clear that he sometimes had trouble understanding his own conditions and navigating the computer and telephone trees that you sometimes have to do to figure out where to go for what.
How common is that to, as John did until very recently, not have that home, not have the main doctor who sees you every couple of months, or at least even once a year?
I think it's very common, and there's a lot of academic studies that have been done about people who don't have what they call a medical home. Their care is piecemeal. If something really bad happens, they go to the ER, and if something less bad happens, they might try to find a clinic, but that clinic might not have all the services they need. It's also very hard for these patients to get specialty care, so they go to a clinic. If they have a condition where they really need a specialist, but there's no specialist there, and it's extremely difficult to get appointments with specialists, many of whom don't want to take Medicaid patients. So they get kind of caught in a cycle where they don't go because the service isn't very available. They wait till they're very sick, and then either they go to an emergency room where they're treated and often get very good treatment, but then they're spit back out in the street, and there's no guarantee that they will get the follow-up or do the follow-up care that they themselves need to remain in good health. So that's, we see, and medical systems all over the country are seeing this problem of patients who, while they're poor, actually end up costing the system a lot of money because of that high use of the emergency room.
So you've outlined some of the challenges here. How does this end up in terms of outcomes? How much worse are people's health or maybe mortality if they're in these low-income urban areas?
What we documented in this series is this very powerful connection between poverty itself and poor health. While we were trying to show that there's health deserts and that sometimes people have trouble getting access, that's not the whole story. Even in countries such as England, where they have socialized medicine and people should have equal access, you still see the disparity between poor patients and wealthier patients. We see it in higher rates of chronic disease. We see it in higher rates of premature mortality and higher rates of all sorts of illnesses. So a lot of research has been done academically, again, on what they call social determinants of health. And that means aspects of living in poverty that directly contribute to poor health, as opposed to something that you get and your wealthier neighbor could get to. This is just something that you live with. That might be something like a child who has asthma living in an apartment with mold, so that it's hard for that child to get better because they keep going back to an environment that aggravates their problem. So that is one of the things that has been well documented and that we tried to show in the series, that it's not just access to care, but it's a very, very living in poverty that can lead to poor health.
We're talking to Lillian Thomas from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about her special series on health and poverty. It's being published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this summer.
We're taking your calls next. Have you struggled to navigate the healthcare system in the United States? Do you live in a health desert? Are you in a low-income area with little access to healthcare in a city or a rural area? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation now with Lillian Thomas of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about the special series she's working on that examines the link between poverty and health in Milwaukee and beyond.
And we're taking your calls now. Have you struggled to navigate the healthcare system in the United States? Do you live in a low-income area without a lot of access to healthcare in city or rural? Call and share your experiences. And do you work in healthcare, especially in one of these low-income areas? Call and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. To your calls in just a moment. But Lillian, I know one of the upcoming parts of your series is on solutions. Can you give us a taste of what kind of solutions are being floated out there, maybe being tried around the country?
Sure. I did quite a bit of reporting both in Milwaukee and Pittsburgh, but also in other cities where they're trying new things. And one of the major states that really is embarking on this is Oregon. They have an almost $2 billion federal grant to try to target Medicaid patients and figure out ways that they can both improve care and reduce costs, which would be the wonderful win-win that we would all like to see. And what they've been able to do is take the money and do things that aren't directly medical care issues. And sometimes they call it going upstream, where you try to address the social problem or the preventive problem rather than waiting until the patient shows up on your doorstep very sick. An example that I was given there that actually the governor of the state has used because he's a big supporter is you have a man who lives in a four-story walk-up, and he has a heart condition and a lot of respiratory problems, and he keeps having relapses where he gets very, very ill and goes to the ER and is treated and then goes home again, where he's in this hot walk-up and doesn't manage his fluids well and eventually gets sick again. What they decided to do was buy an air conditioner. They said, we're spending thousands and thousands of dollars treating this guy over and over. What if we spent $300, bought an air conditioner, and had a homemade check on him and help him manage his fluids? This person would be paid a much lower hourly rate than the ER docs and all the technical things that are being used to help him in the hospital. So that's the kind of pretty innovative things that they are trying in Oregon to catch people before they get really sick and try to keep them well instead of waiting for them to get very sick and show up in the emergency room. They are also experimenting in Oregon, and this is we found in other cities too, with trying to use outreach workers who might go to the home, who might call people and do consults on the phone or even just do simple things like remind them of appointments. of providing transportation in some cases, because as I said, sometimes low-income people have a great deal of trouble just getting to where they need to go. And so some places have experimented with vans to go pick people up, which is an expense for them. But if you don't have people missing appointments, if you get them in to see a primary care doc instead of waiting till they're sick, again, the idea is that you save money by spending some money in preventive or other kinds of services.
Well, good.
Go ahead.
I want to jump in and get to our callers now. We've got
sure.
Ellen on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I do have direct experience of the American medical system's total failure and abandonment of working poor and uninsured people. My own sister this past June went into the hospital in Chicago with a very serious infection. She was she had successful surgery, and then because of being poor and having no insurance, she was sent to a nursing care center that called itself a hospital, and there the care was neglectful, filthy, beyond my description trying to keep short here. I was there, and my other sister was there, and thank God my other sister is in the medical community. Otherwise, we wouldn't have even gotten, it was a battle every day to get decent care, which she never got. Therefore, she got weaker and weaker. She developed infections in that place. She was sent back to the hospital twice, back to Kindred twice, and on the third, weaker every time. And on the third time back to the hospital, we said, that's it. We're taking her to Milwaukee. She was in an apartment successfully for a month. Unfortunately, she fell and broke a bone. And I have one light in this story, and that is Sinai Samaritan Hospital was the place she went and where she was when she passed away. And the hospital was kind and skillful to both her and us, our family. But the previous 8 months were horrid.
Ellen, I'm very sorry about your story and sorry for your loss. Lillian, is that a case that you found around the country where sometimes even where there is access to some kind of health care, it might not be good, it might not be good quality?
Yes, I didn't focus on that because sometimes, as I said, the care is excellent, but the problem is the patient then goes home and gets sick again. But there is a two-tier system or a three-tier system, and I've talked to a lot of people about that question, saying, are we moving more and more toward this? And many academics and doctors will tell you we're already there, that people who can pay, who have good private insurance, get a very different level of care from people who can't. And that's not always true. As you said, Sinai gives excellent, excellent service, and many, many hospitals that serve the poor are excellent. So I wouldn't want to say that's always the issue. But certainly in many cases, the clinics or the institutions, long care institutions, are just not giving the kind of care that is the minimum that would be required to really do a decent job of serving patients.
Ellen, thanks for the call and sharing your story. And again, very sorry for your loss. Lillian, before I let you go, who is trying to fill in the gap in Milwaukee, say, where there's a perceived health care desert?
There are a lot of free clinics and also the federally qualified health centers, which are funded by the federal government and have some access to lower malpractice insurance and other things that make it possible for them to serve the poor. And there are also a lot of these free clinics. I think a lot of hospitals also are really trying to improve their access, their outreach, and sending nurses out into the community and setting up small clinics on the premise or close by. There's a lot of strong free clinics that are affiliated with hospitals. So I do think that there's many people who are trying to fill in the gap, but that there is a lot of money in healthcare, and the fact that, again, we see the building out in the suburbs means that money is not going into institutions or to pay the salaries of people who might serve the poor in their own neighborhoods.
Lillian, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Lillian Thomas. She's Assistant Managing Editor of Special Projects at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We're talking about a series she's doing on the connection between poverty and poor health. It's currently running in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.